Welcome back. Hour number two is upon us, and we appreciate you very much being part of hour number one. If you were, if not, if you're just coming in for the first time, come on in. Water's fine. We got a great program for you. This is Tony Beam, Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference and where we are equipping transformational leaders for the church and society. I also serve as the Director of Public Affairs, along with my colleague Lisa Van Riper, and I'm the director of the Office of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention. My co-host is Austin Barker.
Hi, everybody.
We've got Drew McKissick on the phone. It is time for our visit with him, and of course, he is the chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party. We've been searching for a topic all morning to talk about, so I thought you might have an idea when you called in, because we've kind of been short on ideas here this morning.
I can't imagine y'all being out of things to talk about. It just seems like some kind of a metaphysical impossibility.
Well, obviously, my phone started blowing up last night. I went to an event at Bob Jones University to hear Jim DeMint and Dr. Ben Carson, and Ellen Weaver. And by the time I was walking in the door at home, my phone started blowing up. So, just give us your gut reaction to the Politico blockbuster story about the draft.
Well, a couple of things. First off is the fact that there was actually a story to be written, which means that there was a leak from the Supreme Court, which I find interesting. That has rarely, if ever, happened in modern history of the U.S. Supreme Court to have a draft opinion leak, especially prior to a case being finalized and adjudicated. It leads me to believe that, some of our liberal friends inside the court and or their, staffers and, staffers to staffers or whatever it may be, decided that they would, roll this out there and try to generate backlash prior to the decision actually being rendered, because it's not final until it's published. And potentially push maybe, one justice off of the what appears to be the majority, opinion. That aside, in terms of an opinion, though, just what I read that they had published, Alito obviously has a great mind and actually did a great job picking apart the fact that, Roe, as it was written, actually makes no legal sense whatsoever, no constitutional sense. Even liberal legal scholars have admitted as much. So it's not surprising. And the fact that I guess if I have a big surprise to what looks like maybe the decision, it would be that Justice Roberts did not do what, I thought that he might have done, which would have been to vote in the majority so that he could actually control writing the decision, which is the way the inner dynamics work. They'll come in after hearing your case. They'll go into the chamber, they'll all vote, and then the senior judge within the winning coalition, if you will, is the one who controls who gets to write the decision. And, he tends to be, an incrementalist, if you will. And I would have thought that he probably would have voted with the majority so that he could actually write the decision himself. But that did not happen, apparently. We don't know.
Well, the interesting thing about that, too, is there was speculation a few days ago about the Supreme Court, because Roberts had written the majority opinion on another case, and that would have been the second or third opinion that he had written, which would have been unprecedented. That normally, these guys spread out the opinion writing. And so some speculated just by the fact that Roberts had already written on two previous majority opinions, that meant that he was not going to write the majority opinion on this, on the Dobbs case, which now appears to be correct because Alito wrote it. Let me ask you this. To me, what this says is that this is from February. So first of all, this is a first draft. And if you read it, it's rough. You can tell that this is not what was going to be released for consumption, because there's some statements that would need to be massaged and so forth. There are a couple of places where Alito is very blunt about the unconstitutionality, which probably would have been couched in some lesser blunt language when the final draft gets released. But what I think happened is that this was where the court was shortly after the oral arguments. The draft was written, And the reason it wasn't leaked then is because whoever leaked it was waiting to see, as we got closer to the release date, if there was any movement. And here we are at the 1st of May, and I think this is an indication that there's been no movement among the five.
I agree.
And so now this is the last that they realize this thing is going to culmination. So they release this as a desperation effort to intimidate and bully the court.
I agree with you. I think that makes total sense. And I think what's going to be interesting to see, and whether or not we actually see or hear anything that happens internally in the court as a result of this leak in terms of, you know, staffing, staff issues, you know, control over processes and stuff like that, that, you know, to prevent this kind of leak mapping again. Because obviously of all the cases where you could have a leak like this, and at this point in time before a decision is actually published, you know, this is the case of cases, if you will. You know, it couldn't get any bigger than this one in terms of a leak.
Right.
And I think they'll probably take steps to deal with that going forward, I would imagine.
Roberts, you know Roberts is furious because he is, above all, a protector of the procedures of the court and the place
right.
of the court
right.
and the doing things in the right way. And so I can't imagine what he's the anger that he's feeling this morning. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I think Roberts probably wanted to allow the Mississippi law to stand, but he wanted to leave Roe and Casey alone. But he got outvoted mm-hmm. by the other five.
Yep.
And so, mm-hmm. boy, does that ever draw a circle around the influence of Donald Trump? Because you go back and look, Alito
Absolutely.
Was put on the court by George W. Bush, Clarence Thomas by mm-hmm. George H.W. Bush, and then the mm-hmm. other three were all three appointed by Trump. So...
I mean, that in and of itself right there, if anybody ever asks you whether or not elections matter, whether or not voting actually matters, there's the answer to your question right there
yeah.
in a nutshell.
To put a highlighter on that is to say that those justices replaced – Scalia was one of the ones that was replaced there.
Right.
But the other
right.
two were Kennedy and Ginsburg.
Right.
And, I mean, and the fact – this is the most ironic and delicious irony is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her choice not to retire when she was being pressured to do so, but to serve out mm-hmm. – protect her own legacy,
right.
okay, and serve out until her last breath, literally
– that's right.
Her choice to do that was probably one of the most single instrumental factors in the overturning of Roe.
Yeah.
How
well,
about that?
The
RBG, absolutely. The notorious
absolutely.
RBG, is almost single-handedly responsible
for
Amy Coney Barrett taking her place in overturning Roe.
Yeah, the fact that she didn't give Obama
right.
an opportunity.
Right.
Or some, yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So
right,
RBG, thank you very much for that.
Let's switch gears here a little bit, talk about South Carolina, because today... gentlemen, start your engines in the House and the Senate. We're going to have, if I understand correctly, debate over Save Women's Sports in the Senate. They set that for special order. That's going to come up today. And in the House, the battle will begin about whether we're going to have medical marijuana. And the question is very simple. Do we have enough amendments? Do we have enough procedural maneuvers to keep that vote from coming? Because if it comes, it's going to pass.
I believe so, and I've talked to a good number of the folks on the conservative side there working to stop this, and their strategy that they have to do that procedurally and also constitutionally up front, you know, as to whether
right.
or not the bill can even be taken up. Because here's the thing that hasn't been talked about a lot: that bill generates revenue.
That's right.
And if you look at our state constitution, it says that all revenue-generating bills must originate in the House of Representatives. This
yes.
bill originated in the Senate.
That's right.
So the question is whether or not the House guys are going to be protective of their prerogative constitutionally as being the only chamber that can initiate a revenue bill. So there's that issue to be taken up. And then there's, if that objection were to be overcome and we proceed to full debate, then you've got... I think at least 1,000 amendments that have been lined up by the side that's looking to stop the bill. But the bottom line is what this issue is about. This issue is not about compassionate care. This issue is about, quite frankly, just bold it, underline it, whether or not the marijuana industry is going to be able to take root in South Carolina, the production
right.
of it
mm-hmm.
and the dispensing of it.
Yes.
Period. You know, if this were just about compassionate care, then you can create a small program and put DHEC in charge of it.
That's
know?
Right.
But the simple fact is medicine is not medicine. Medicine is something that is approved by the FDA, prescribed by a doctor, picked up in a licensed pharmacy in controlled doses. That is not what this does. You know, take two Tokes and call me in the morning is not a prescription, you know. This is an issue that, again, it's almost like being back in the days when video poker first set root in South Carolina, and then what grew out of that, and what we had to basically kill legally eventually, and almost cost us dearly politically in the state. That's where we are right now, and we've got to make sure that we can stop this. I would encourage everybody to call your state house member today. Tell them you do not want marijuana and the marijuana industry to take root in South Carolina.
Well, and tell them that you want the House of Representatives to defend the South Carolina Constitution and their own fiduciary responsibility in being the originator of legislation that calls for added revenue.
That's right.
So, I know I've never seen you mad. You're one of the coolest cucumbers I've ever been around in terms of politics. You understand that it's a process, and you roll with punches, and you're firm and aggressive in pursuing what you believe is right, but you don't get ruffled very often. But man, this election reform thing that went down in flames, I saw Drew McKissick get angry.
So here's the good news. We had 20 things that were on our wish list for election reform this year. 18 of those things got put in legislation by the House of Representatives.
Yep.
In the course of two bills and got sent over to the Senate. One of those bills passed the House unanimously, by the way. And then the Senate proceeded to take both bills, sort of wrap them into one bill. And then that was when they put on what amounted to a killer amendment, which would expand the Senate's power over election commissioners, who, by the way, sit as judges in appeals of election cases or whatever for those very same senators and House members. So I don't know how you can say that they should be able to, you know, have control over who their own judges are, but that's a whole other matter. We can be agnostic about whether they should have advice and consent over election commissioners. The simple fact is there is virtually unanimous agreement among Republicans and a whole lot of Democrats about the other thing, everything else that's in this bill. Why introduce something that would be a killer amendment that there's disagreement on? Let's do what everybody agrees on and get this done so that it can take effect in this election year and the governor can sign it. So I'd encourage folks, call your senators, tell them, negotiate with the House, take off this killer amendment so this bill can get passed. I noticed the House on Thursday in the Judiciary Committee attached the election reform bill to 9 different bills that they're going to be sending out of the House over to the Senate today. So basically it's like,
excellent,
you know, the House sending the same bill over to them 9 more times and, you know, emphasizing and underlining in bold that this is our position. You know, you need to agree with it. You come to the terms of this position. I was glad to see them stand strong on that. We just got to get our senators to agree to come to the table and let's get this thing done.
Drew, I appreciate your time today. You've given us a lot of it, a lot of great commentary. We will. I'll be headed to Columbia in just a little while, and be down there for the week to see what happens. We've got 6 days. Sine die is a week from Thursday, so we'll just see where it goes. So, thank you, my friend. Appreciate it very much.
Y'all take care. Thank you.
Austin and I attended an event last night. It was at Bob Jones University, and it was a conversation with former Senator Jim DeMint, former head of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Ben Carson, and future, possibly, Superintendent of Education in South Carolina, Ellen Weaver. So
Did you get to hobnob with any of the quality up there? Did you eventually make it up onto the platform at all?
Yeah, I talked to, Senator DeMint and I have a really good relationship, and I hadn't seen him in a while, so I wanted to get up there and talk to him, and that was good.
I got to meet Joey Hudson, competition. So
it was nice.
He said to tell you hi, by the way.
Yeah, I talked to him for a little bit.
Okay, gotcha.
I really like Joey.
Yeah.
I appreciate you listening to this show.
right.
But I like Joy and would never say anything because he does a good job.
And then I got to talk to Senator DeMint, and I sent him an email. We'll see if I have any influence in the world at all because I asked him if he'd come on the show. I did that without your permission. But anyway,
oh, sure.
I sent him an email.
Goodness.
So anyway,
he's been on here many times.
I knew
many
that you wouldn't mind.
Yeah,
so.
Sure.
But I do have a couple gripes that I just have to get off my chest.
All right.
Okay. So because whenever I go and I hear politicians speak, I always come away with one of two complaints. complaints. And I actually like heard myself talking last night, and I said, oh my goodness, I realized that. So the event actually told me something important about me. And so one of my critiques of politicians is that they tend to avoid the question and they just go to their notes and they just say, like, it doesn't matter what question you ask them, they're going to say what they came prepared to say. And so it's like they'll bend and twist to make their answer match your question. And I'm like, can you please just give a direct, straightforward answer to my question? Yes or no would be fine. You know, so just say something short instead of this long-winded answer. That's one of my critiques of politicians, criticism, complaints. The other one is exactly the opposite. They give out some little bumper sticker slogan. I'm like, oh, come on, quit sloganeering and actually say something of substance. So I figured out that on either side, I'm like, you didn't say enough or you said too much. Basically, I think I learned about myself that I just don't like to hear politicians talk at all.
Well, here's what fascinates me about that is if we were talking about an actual candidate forum or a candidate debate,
yeah,
then I would share some of your frustration when they don't answer direct questions when they're on the seat for the purpose of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, I went in there with total expectation that we were going to get long discussions about philosophy, and some of it would drift into other areas. Because that was not a candidate debate. The only one running for office up there was Ellen Weaver,
mm-hmm.
and it was a discussion about education. I expected that to be broad. I expected the questions to be. And some of the questions, quite frankly, were wide enough that you could drive a Mack truck through.
That's right.
So it gave them the opportunity. Very few questions had any specificity to them at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just
so that's why that I'm not really criticizing those three, because all three of those people, I'm a fan, you know?
And I thought they had good
things to say. They didn't say anything I disagreed with. As a matter of fact, Senator DeMint said some things that I actually applauded. I'm usually one to just kind of sit on my hands. And that's my second complaint is, come on, people, standing ovation, really? Really, is everything a standing ovation? Listen, if everything is a standing ovation, then a standing ovation means nothing at all. Dr. Ben Carson, would you please welcome to the stage to give a warm South Carolina welcome to Dr. Ben Carson. Everybody stands up. He walked on the stage, for crying out loud. Why give him a standing ovation? And then, let me compare it. Gary Smith serves in the legislature, the South Carolina legislature, for 20 years of faithful conservative service to our state. And we say, thank you, Mr. Gary Smith, for your service. Standing ovation. Do you see the disparity between these two things? One guy walks on the stage and the other guy gives 20 years of his life to the state, and they got the same response. Standing ovation. If a standing ovation doesn't, if it means, if you give it for everything, means nothing.
Are your headphones working? I mean, can you hear what you're saying?
I'm not done yet. I still have more to say.
Well, here's the thing. Come on, Austin, honestly, the standing ovation for Dr. Carson, he's not been in South Carolina, as far as I know, since Truth for a New Generation brought him to Spartanburg back before he was a candidate, unless he might have swung through when he was campaigning at one point. But he hasn't been in South Carolina very much, and certainly not since he served as head of Housing and Urban Development. He has great respect from the people in South Carolina. That standing ovation that he got wasn't for walking on the stage. It was for serving for 4 years in the Trump administration and for being faithful to that service. And it was our opportunity to express to him our support for who he is as a person. So that, and the reason Jim DeMint getting one is because Jim DeMint's gotten them forever. And people are very comfortable with Jim DeMint and love him. But they get opportunity to express that to him a lot more often than they do with Ben Carson. And the reason that you do for Gary Smith, it's the same reason. Gary Smith served faithfully for 20 years and deserved a standing ovation. He's one of the best, most conservative, most consistent leaders that we've ever had in Columbia. He's a good friend. He teaches at North Greenville political science, and we're so blessed to have him. He's going to continue to do that even though he's leaving the legislature, and that is a big plus for North Greenville. But So in essence, the crowd was expressing the same thing. Dr. Carson, thank you for 4 years of faithful service in the federal government, in the Trump administration. What an awesome job you did. Gary Smith, thank you for 20 years of serving in the South Carolina legislature. What an awesome job you did. That's why they got standing ovations.
Standing ovations are overdone.
Okay.
I heard you, and your points are legitimate. Okay. But I just feel like it dilutes it.
Look,
because
I've been
what you say is when you applaud, you know, you put your hands together like this, and you're like, I agree with what you said. And then whenever you applaud louder, it means I really agree. And then when you stand up and applaud, it's like, I really, really, really agree. There's some gradation there that we need, and we need to save that standing ovation for a 10. Don't give 5-star reviews on Amazon for crying out loud. 5-star review at a restaurant means you blew my expectations out of the water. Like, you really exceeded my expectations. If you go there and it's a good steak and you got good service and they refilled your water glass, give them a 4-star review.
Now that you've heard that, please go to our podcast sites and give us a 5-star review. Every one of you.
Because it's that
and
good.
Then give us one on Facebook as well. Look, I've been in venues where standing ovations were overdone and they became trite.
Right.
Last night was not one of them. You're right. Standing ovations can be they can become meaningless, and mm-hmm. and like I said, the last time I remember it was Jeff Duncan. This is no reflection on Jeff Duncan or his barbecue. It's one of the best events of the year. I love going. I go every year, and I love Christy Noem, the presentation that she made. But we were like Jack in the Boxes, and it just got to be ridiculous after a while. Mm. But that's on the crowd. That's not on anybody, the organizers or anything else.
Totally.
Last night I actually felt it was very appropriate. I didn't stand at one point simply because when you've got titanium steel knees with space age plastic kneecaps, there's just so many standing ovations as you can give within a certain period of time.
But the point is right.
Without being in pain.
The accusation that Austin's a jerk is appropriate at some point, because I was literally the only person sitting in the whole auditorium at one point, because I'm like, I'm not going to stand up.
I knew
not going to do it.
There was a source for this, and it's because I leaned over last night. I said, you're a jerk.
I forgot about that. This
is where every bit of this is coming from.
No,
all right. You know, behold the perseverance of the candidate David Vaughn, because he really thought he was going to be on the radio at 8:05. So he's still here. That's really pretty good. That's a point right there, a point in favor.
Great.
All right. Let's start this way. Gary Smith, we've already talked about it a little bit. I mean, he's served almost 20 years. In the House. He's been a conservative leader, a stalwart, somebody that has gained respect of people in both parties. So that's his legacy as he goes to take care of his family. I told him last night, I said, look, I really hate seeing you go, but I respect the fact that you would choose the well-being of your family and your responsibility as a son and taking that over the idea of political service, because some things are just more important, you know.
Family.
So, and I think that's one of them. So, when you think about that, how would you approach trying to build a legacy or stepping into that legacy to protect it if you were elected to this office?
Well, let me just mirror what you said, Tony. It's big shoes. I have met no one. When they ask what seat I'm running for, and I tell them seat 27, Gary Smith's retiring, and it's always the same reaction.
Yeah.
What a wonderful man! If I call, he answers, and it's just amazing to hear that legacy left behind, Gary. Yeah. And even though it might have got Austin a little upset about standing ovation, but yeah, Gary's very deserving. Everybody there loves Gary, it's huge. Huge shoes to fill, and I tell you, I've done a lot of just studying what he's done, just to look and see the bills that he's presented and the things that he stand behind, just because I know he is a man of that district.
Are you a consistent conservative in the same way that Gary Smith is?
I am a consistent conservative. Well, I look at, you know, conservatism, a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is an important word to Gary. It's a very important word for me.
Let's talk a little bit about you
Sure.
and your family. You're a believer. You're
absolutely
a Protestant, born again believer.
Yes. Sir.
So Baptist, Methodist.
I grew up Church of God, and married my wife who was a Baptist, and switched over.
Yeah, so you're a Baptist.
I'm a Baptist. Gotcha.
Yeah,
That's right. That's
so,
right.
So, and your faith is important to you.
Very important.
It forms the core of who you are. From a lot of people don't understand that when they say, you know, if they wear Christianity as a label, it doesn't mean much. If they live the Christian life as a person, which is what we're called to, Jesus calls us to, then that becomes the anchor of your. You know, your philosophy and your decisions.
Right.
And is that the way you describe yourself?
Absolutely. With what you were talking about earlier, that with all this going on with the Supreme Court and all, you know, darkness, light always wins over darkness.
Yeah.
And that's really is, it comes from within, is that light.
And when the darkness is revealing itself because the light is shining.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's what, this would be the light of truth.
That's
on
right.
The sanctity of life. And what would you expect the darkness to do? They're going to try to their best to overcome.
That's right.
And so what we have to do, I think, is just maintain our Christian witness and testimony and stand firm on what the truth is.
Absolutely.
But anyway, tell us a little bit about your background. How long have you been in South Carolina? How'd you meet your wife? What do you do for a living?
Okay. Well, I was born here in Greenville General. You don't hear too many people say that anymore, right? But lived in Malden for the first 30 years of my life and moved to Simpsonville for the last 27. I'm 57 years old. I've raised three children. My parents grew up in this area. My three children have grown up in this area. District 27 pretty much has been my home my whole life.
Right.
And
you and your wife have been married for...
We've been married 32 years. We met at the neighborhood pool in Malden.
Yeah.
Yeah. We both graduated Malden High School, both graduated University of South Carolina. And
go Gamecocks.
How about that?
So when you think about, you know, those things, what was it in your background? What do you do for a living?
I
forgot to ask you.
In 1996, I built my first self-storage facility.
Okay.
And got into that world of real estate development, self-storage. I'm a serial entrepreneur. We tried so many different businesses. You know, when we went through that tough time in 2008, if you held real estate, you took a beating. We ventured out into some other businesses, but self-storage is my primary business, I do now.
Okay. When you heard that Gary Smith was not going to run again, have you run for office before?
I have never run before.
Why did you decide this time? What made you decide this is the right place and time?
That's a great question. Well, at first, when I heard that Gary was retiring, we were talking, and I said, I'm going to run for that seat. But I wasn't serious in my head. I was just kind of thinking, I should run for that. And then I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. And then I got some phone calls from respected people who said, you should run for that seat. And so I went through a lot of prayer, talked to friends and family that I trust, and I probably decided to run and not to run about 80 times, back and forth. And you know, and I prayed, and I talked to a friend of mine and who's gone through a lot of health issues in the last year. And he said, God uses people who'll say they will. And you need to seek God's guidance, stay in his will. And I feel like that's the calling I have gotten to run for the seat.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. Have you thought about roads, infrastructure? That's on the minds of a lot of South Carolinians. I just moderated a candidate forum over in Spartanburg a few weeks ago where a lot of questions revolved around, because they were submitted, that revolved around the state of our roads and what needs to be done about it. What do you think about that?
It's a huge topic on everybody's mind because every one of us drive and every one of us hit that pothole and it upsets us. Infrastructure is a big thing. I've been on the GLDTC, which is a long acronym for the Greenville Legislative Delegation Transportation Committee.
Okay.
And that's the C fund from the state. So I've been on that for the last 4 years, and I've got to see, I tell you, that's a great group, by the way. I think every county, Greenville County does it. I think every county should do it like Greenville County, and not because I'm on the board. It's just handled. That money is spent the way everybody on that board spends that money, like it's their own and like it's the people that they represent. Very similar to District 27 that I represent on that committee. And, you know, infrastructure is just huge. It affects everyone. It's more than just roads. It's water. It's sewer. So it's one of those things. I think you have to get developers and the government working together. You know, we've got such a surplus right now that this money, infrastructure, there's no one that you talk to that is not gridlocked in traffic probably right now. And so if we can get started ahead of the game, and these developers and these municipalities and our government can work together, I think that's going to solve a lot of these infrastructure issues.
What's your philosophy on taxes? What's the government's role, local and state, on taxation?
Taxation without representation, right? I'm against, you know, I think that, you know, taxes are definitely moving in the right direction right now, Tony. I mean, our state legislators just voted to reduce. And I mean, right. You know, someone talked last night about the ebb and flow of in as our leaders.
Dr. Carson.
Yeah, Dr. Carson. And when our taxes are high, our society doesn't do well. When our taxes are low, our society does well. Right. That's why there's an ebb and flow. It's not that that's the way it has to be. That's the way that it has been for the last 100 years.
Right. Relationship with development and the government. A lot of people think that the government should give incentives to businesses to get them to come to South Carolina. Some people say, no, we just need to have a tax plan for everybody that's equal. And then, you know, we let the market sort all that out instead of the government picking winners and losers. So what do you think about all that?
Well, I've been in a lot of successful businesses in the last 20 years. And, you know, I look back when I first started my career, I was in textiles. Mm-hmm. I was outside sales. Everything was textiles. And then I know that Carol Campbell came into a lot of scrutiny about getting BMW here in the incentives, but you think about this Greenville economy that we're in right now without BMW, you wonder what it would be like.
Yeah,
you know, because in the latter part of my years in outside sales, I was calling on only automotive, so there's a place for that, Tony.
Yeah, there's been 200, I believe the last I checked, around 250 auxiliary businesses mm-hmm. that are in South Carolina, many of those in the upstate, mm-hmm. because of BMW choosing to locate here.
Right, right. And there's other states that are vying for these businesses.
Right.
And South Carolina has to be competitive, but it has to absolutely be on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. So, in other words, you would agree with some incentives,
yeah.
but not giving away the store.
Correct.
So to speak.
Yeah. There's okay. Not every deal is a good deal.
Yeah. Let me ask you about education. We talked about that was a big discussion last night, obviously. Ellen Weaver is a candidate for the Republican Party for the superintendent of education. So, a lot of the questions revolved around that. What would you like to see in South Carolina? We're probably going to get a limited, and I mean very limited, school choice bill that's
right.
going to allow. You're going to have to meet the standard of being, I think, 100% below the poverty line. You know, federal poverty line that's set. You're going to have to be in a failing school before you can take a savings account and go to another school or a private school or a charter school. So, how would you expand school choice in South Carolina, or would you?
Absolutely. My three children. I've had children that went to public school, private school, charter schools. We're able to make that choice, mm-hmm. and I think that every parent it needs to be in the power in the parents' hands.
Right.
And you're right; it's a very stripped down version right now, but it's a step in the right direction. And so, just like they said last night, teachers are This is not a bill against teachers or the public school teachers. This is not that at all. I support teachers, and their job, to me, is the toughest job in the world. I really admire teachers and what they do. I mean, it's a full-time job.
Right.
I mean, all day.
Well, and I'm with you on that. I mean, I admire public school teachers. I appreciate what they did. My wife was one for a number of years before she came to work here at His Radio after our youngest daughter was born. So I'm 100% with you on that. And I think you're right to point out that school choice, most parents want to support good teachers. They just don't want to have to be not have any choice over the teachers that don't take their responsibilities as seriously.
That's right.
And it's just like everything. I mean, there are good teachers that are conscientious, and I would say in South Carolina, that's the majority. But in those cases where some teachers have decided that it's not that important, parents should be able to say, not for my child, I want them to go over here where they do take it seriously.
That's right.
And that's really what a education savings account bill would allow. Okay, lightning round, because we're going to run out of time here. But just some hot-button question issues. Would you support the Save Women Sports bill that's in the Senate that would protect women from having to compete against biological males?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you believe that that we're gone too far down this transgender road and that we need to set some legal parameters for protection for privacy?
It's out of control.
Yeah. Okay. Medical marijuana that be debated. You heard us talk to Drew McKissick about that. Would you support that bill?
You know that my family has dealt with the opioid addiction. My wife is a pharmacist. I'm very, I look forward to watching today to hear the debate. Mm-hmm. I will vote. One of my primary goals will be to make sure that recreational marijuana does not happen in this state.
Right. But you see a purpose for what's called medical marijuana?
Well, it's got to be extremely regulated. It can't be if the, which I don't know the entire basis of this bill. I mean, they got 1,000 amendments, I think, that I've heard that they're going through.
They're going to go through today.
And
start today.
If it would, regardless of what it's called, if it's going to lead to the advancement of recreational marijuana, I would vote against it.
Yeah. I think any bill that opens the door is going to end up that way.
Okay.
But that's, it doesn't matter. That I respect those that the people that are concerned about this, they're not thinking about recreational, the majority of them. They're thinking about individuals who would benefit from it. I know the people that there are people that are, I consider friends of mine, good folks in the legislature that believe this is a good idea. I disagree with them, but I believe the reason they think it's a good idea is because they want to help people.
Right.
They're not trying to do something other than that. So I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
All right. Pro-life, you would restrict abortion as far as we can restrict it.
If
Roe versus Wade is truly gone, then South Carolina could be abortion free and you would support that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Good deal. All right, David, thank you. You've given us a lot of time this morning.
Tony, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate you being on the program. And if people want to find out about your candidacy, what do they do?
VaughnForSC.com.
Okay.
VaughnForSC.
Okay, VaughnForSC.com.
Yes, sir.
Gotcha. Okay, I just got an update here from the Washington Post. Leaked Supreme Court draft ignites fierce debate over future of abortion. Let's see here. The United States and anti-abortion activists are expressing cautious optimism that the court is on the verge of pushing decisions about the legality of the procedure to the states. Now, notice again, anti-abortion activist. These are not pro. They will not use the term pro-life. You're not going to hear any of the progressive-leaning media, refer to these people as pro-life, and for the most part, because that's what we are. But it's better to characterize us as anti. Because we're just against people. We're against women. We're against, And that's absolutely ridiculous. Nothing could be further from the truth. And yet that's what they push. Report Monday night by Politico. Yeah, we know what that says. I'm trying to see if there's something new in this story because it just came out. Doesn't look like it.
Well, ought to be a good.
I mean, that's a
good conversation on The View today.
Oh, well, yeah. Leaked draft opinion triggers fierce reactions. Yeah, that's what I was looking for. Activists planning next steps, and then it really doesn't go into any of that. Of course, there hasn't been a whole lot of time.
No.
What would happen if Roe versus Wade were overturned? It's showing a map here of the states that would ban abortion. And it looks like there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 outright bans. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 that would be greatly restricted when it comes to abortion. Mm-hmm. So,
a lot of them below the Mason-Dixon line?
Well, most of them, yeah. I think, might be a couple that are outside. Texas. Of course, that's below the Mason-Dixon line.
There you go.
So, all right. Another story from the Supreme Court today that is, we would have led with this. I mean, this would have been our first story had not the Politico story got leaked. But in a rare unanimous ruling on Monday, the Supreme Court secured a major victory for free speech. This is by Sarah Parshall Perry, writing for the Daily Signal. The court determined that in the opinion in Shurtleff versus Boston, authored by retiring Justice Stephen Breyer, the court ruled that the city of Boston violated the Constitution when it prohibited a group from flying a Christian flag on a flagpole it had held open to other groups and their flags. Now, this was a unanimous decision, and it's a free speech decision written by Stephen Breyer, of all people. So this is how egregious this decision was by Boston. When you've got three left progressives on the court, and all three of them go, are you kidding me? You can't curtail Christian speech in this manner. That's a pretty good indicator that free speech, and particularly in this case, Christian speech, is not going to be able to be curtailed. The court determined that simply by permitting private groups to fly their flags on the city flagpole, the city was not endorsing any message behind those flags, and that therefore the flag and what it represents did not constitute government speech. As a result, it's a refusal to allow a religious group to raise its flag simply because of its religious viewpoint was a violation of the free speech clause of the First Amendment. And that was so obvious. Boston had historically allowed groups to raise a flag on one of the city's three flagpoles in conjunction with ceremonies held on the City Hall Plaza. Over a period of 12 years between 2005 and 2017, the city approved the flying of 50 different flags in conjunction with 284 events. The only one they prohibited was the Christian flag, and they should have known they couldn't get by with this. I mean, this is such a blatant attack against and discrimination against Christians and Christianity, that they had to know that this was not going to stand. The interesting thing, the Supreme Court took this decision to make this statement, and they made it with a full-throated enthusiasm by all nine justices. You have to allow equal access. Religion has to be protected. All speech should be protected under the Constitution. Glad to hear it. All right, we'll see you tomorrow, 7 o'clock.